Okay, good evening. We're continuing now from where we left off, which was about a month ago, because every Wednesday night was a holiday. So, fortunately, I have some notes that were able to remind me of where we left off. And we are doing the, we're studying the seven mitzvot, the seven commandments of Noah, from the Talmud, the tractate of Sanhedrin, and we are going to continue in our study. What I would like to take up, though, before we go further in the Talmud, it's something which I believe is an important point. We were discussing the survivors in the Andes, that case where those people were stranded on a mountaintop in the Andes, and people died, and the ones that were alive proceeded to consume the bodies of those who were dead. And there was a film that they made out of it, you know, where they interviewed the survivors. And most of them, if not all of them, felt extremely uncomfortable and guilty about what they had done. what I want to point out is that in halacha we have no such phenomenon. The purpose of Torah is to remove man from any kind of primitive taboo feelings about things, and to give man, God's Torah gives man a clear method, a clear way of life, that if he uses his mind, his intelligence, and the Torah which God gave him, he will do the right thing, he will know what the right thing to do is, and he will have no guilt about what he does. On the contrary, he will feel secure that he has done exactly as God has commanded him. That is the beauty and the greatness of Torah, that it's a light, a path, which gives man a clear way of living and doesn't put him in a situation where he does things that he feels are, that they're right and yet he feels guilty about. That is the system of other religions, other than Torah, which works on a taboo basis. I want to give a case in point. I'm going to deviate a bit, and as a matter of fact, I'm going to go into the New Testament just briefly. The taboo, we've been studying for a while now, and I think that that you're beginning to see that this system of Torah is a system of ideas, brilliant ideas, which guide a person in his life. And it shuns the primitive religious concepts of taboo. And taboo, and if you've read my articles, the last few articles I spoke about, the taboo and the symbolic performance, which constitutes practically, I mean, not practically, all religious activities, other religions, is something which is alien to Torah. Torah is very much against that. I mention here, I'd like to make recourse here to Acts 15. In Acts 15, there is a discussion about whether or not the Gentiles should keep the laws of Moses. And again, I must point out the fact that the ones who wrote this, I'm not interested in, you know, a lot of times people discuss historically, well, is the New Testament reliable? Are these really the words of Jesus and the apostles? As far as I'm concerned, it makes no difference to me, because I am just using the book which the religion of Christianity is guided by. And if there were some other kind of statements which we don't have, well, then it makes no difference to us. But the religion which guides most of the world, the Christian world, is guided by this book. And therefore, I use the book itself, and since that's the basis of the religion. Now, in chapter 15 of Acts, you have a really silly question. I mean, anyone who has any knowledge of Torah would simply realize that the whole discussion here is nonsensical. It exhibits an unbelievable ignorance of Torah. The question is whether the Gentiles have to circumcise themselves and if they have to keep the laws. And they claim that the Pharisees said that they do. And then they got together, and they decided that God doesn't want them to do this for some reason, which, of course, is unintelligible if you're going to maintain that the Bible was given by God. obviously you have to follow what God says, and if God says to keep the commandments, that you can't decide not to keep them. Then the question is ridiculous, because anyone that knows Torah knows that God did not command the Gentiles to keep the 613 laws. And so there's no question. Now, if a Gentile wishes to convert, he has that opportunity, he has that option. If he wishes to convert, then, of course, he must keep the commandments, as is stated many times in the Torah, that the ger, the convert, must keep all the commandments of the Torah, just like any Jew, because anyone that wishes to join the 613 system can do so. Any human being can do so. He doesn't have to do so. If he doesn't, then he does not have to be circumcised. He does not have to keep the 613 laws, and the whole discussion is nonsensical. It's a very simple, open-shut case. There's nothing to talk about. But at any rate, they felt for some reason that this was a very important problem that they had to resolve, and their method of resolution was not by offering any insight or any ideas. None, there's not any ideas at all there, just by their own emotions and their own feelings, claiming that they know what God wants them to do for some supernatural manner, which again is against the teachings of Torah. Torah never in the Torah does it say resort to some supernatural way. It tells you to follow the wise scholars of the Torah and to adhere to what God has said in the Torah. You can't just say, well, I feel God doesn't want me to do this. That's ridiculous. So also over here it's stated that they themselves didn't keep the laws. To put a yoke upon the neck, I'm reading from Acts 15:10, now therefore, why tempt ye God to put a yoke upon the neck of the disciples, which neither our fathers nor we are able to bear? That is just about blasphemy, because if God gives you a Torah, God gives you a Bible, and he tells you to keep it, you can't say, well, this is a burden that we can't, and neither our fathers nor we are able to bear. If your fathers and you are unable to bear this burden, then it's your father's fault and your fault. It's not God's fault. The weakness is in you. And this is stated openly again in the Bible, where it says that you will repent. They will repent the sins of their fathers, their own sins and the sins of their fathers, which means that the Torah states quite clearly that if your fathers and you do not keep these commandments, then it's your fault and your father's fault. It's not the Torah's fault. God gave you a perfect Torah, and what you better do is realize that. And bear the yoke of the Torah and keep the commandments, not dispense with them. This is silly, just plain silly. But at any rate, it goes on, and they say, again, another interesting thing here, which I feel I should mention, they try to prove that the Gentiles somehow do not have to keep the Torah, and God's name is upon them. Take a look over here. It says, take a look at the verse in 15, chapter 15. We're in chapter 15 in Acts, and it's verse 15. Okay. We'll start with verse 14, actually. Simon hath declared how God at the first did visit the Gentiles to take out of them a people for his name. Okay, I'm using the King James version. And 15. And to this agree the words of the prophets, as it is written. Now it says, this is a misquote, not quoted properly. They say, after this I will return and will build again the tabernacle of David, which has fallen down, and I will build again the ruins thereof, and I will set it up. What that has to do with anything before is beyond any kind of comprehension. But I assume that they brought this down to bring in the next verse. Now the next verse says, that the residue of men might seek after the Lord, and all the Gentiles upon whom my name is called, saith the Lord, who doeth all these things. I assume that they're just pulling out that little phrase over there where it says, and all the Gentiles upon whom my name is called. So they're trying to say that God is calling to the Gentiles in a very special way, and they're basing it on this little phrase over here, which is, by the way, from Amos. And we'll get to that phrase in a moment. I just want to show you something which is amazing, but it's throughout the New Testament. It's not amazing to me anymore, because it happens time and time again. Now, the verse that they're quoting, where they're pulling out that statement from, is completely mistranslated. I mean, seriously mistranslated. We're talking about Amos 9, and they're quoting verse 11 and 12, okay? Now, take a look at those two verses. It says, on that day, in that day, on that day, which is referring to the Messianic era, so God says, I will erect the tabernacle of David that has fallen, which means basically the kingdom of David. Okay, and the prophet says that God will repair its breaches, and I will raise it up, and I will build it up as in the days of old, which means to say that God is going to bring back the kingdom of David. Now the next verse, and here's the crucial part. The verse in Hebrew is like this. It says, in order that they will inherit the remnants of Edom and all the nations. Now that's referring to the kingdom of David, that they will inherit, they will control, in other words, the kingdom of Edom and all the nations. Of course, that's what the previous verse is explaining, that King David will reign supreme. That means the Messiah will reign supreme. Okay? Now then they say, now the next phrase is, upon whom my name is called, saith the Lord. Now this makes no sense. If you translate it that he's referring to the nations upon whom my name is called, because if God's name is called on those nations, then why are they being inherited by the kingdom of David? Then God should deal. Then they should be the ones that are the in control. But what happens here is that they simply misread the Hebrew. In Hebrew, many times the verse is elliptic. In other words, if you know the Hebrew language, the verse reads like this. Sometimes a phrase which should be transposed to the beginning is left to the end. That's just the style of the prophet in Hebrew. The way to read the verse is as follows. In order that they, the ones upon whom my name is called, shall inherit the remnants of Edom and all the nations. That's exactly what that verse means. It means nothing else. Now they just took the words v'chol ha'goyim, two words, and they took the next four words and mistakenly assumed that the next four words are modifying the first two words. The next four words are not modifying those first two words. What they're doing is they're modifying the previous part of the sentence. So the sentence reads like this. If I gave you an exact translation, and I'm not going to transpose it. I'll just read it to you, and I'll tell you how it's supposed to be translated. In order that they should inherit, means the kingdom of David should inherit the remnants of Edom and all the nations. And now, comma, they, meaning the kingdom of David, the people of Israel, they upon whom my name is called are the ones that are going to do this inheriting. Okay? So, that's exactly what the sentence means, and it makes absolutely no sense to translate it the way they translated it. Because then it has nothing to do with the previous verse, which is the establishing of the house of David, which is obviously David was not a Gentile, and the kingdom of David was the kingdom of the people of Israel. So God is saying he's going to reestablish the kingdom of the people of Israel in the Messianic era. And they, the ones who have God's name, which is the people of Israel, obviously, are going to inherit these other nations. But again, I mean, you just have the total ignorance even with regard to translating a text of the prophets. And basically, that goes on throughout the New Testament, where people are duped into believing that these are quotes, and these quotes are, in the Bible, the Biblical Translation by Schoenfeld, he says in his footnote, very loosely quoted, he states. But it's not loosely quoted, it's mistranslated. Okay. And, alright, I'm not going to belabor that point anymore, but this is found throughout the New Testament where verses are changed, words are changed, and misquoted and twisted into having people believe that these verses mean what they're trying to preach. Okay, but let me get to the main point, the reason why I brought this chapter in. The reason why I brought it in is because these people decided that he can do away with the laws of Torah, and not even because they're not Jews, just for some crazy reason, but whatever. But they made this decision that God's Torah is not really important anymore. And therefore, in verse 19, they say, "Wherefore my sentence is that we trouble not them which from among the Gentiles that turn to God, but that we write unto them that they abstain from," and listen, "pollutions of idols, from fornication, and from things strangled, and from blood." Okay? Now, some people have attempted to quote, have quoted this in an attempt to prove that, that here is the concept of seven laws of Noah. Now, you've been studying for the past few months, I mean several months, we have been studying, we've only covered really the law of blasphemy, okay, and which we analyzed exactly, precisely. We saw how a law of God has to be formulated, and with precision and clarity and understanding. And it is pretty obvious, I think, to all of you, when you just read a verse like this, that abstain from pollutions of idols, from fornication, and from things strangled, and from blood, what are we dealing with? This is not halacha that we're dealing with. This is taboo. This is the taboo system of the pagans and all the other religions. There is no definition, no clarification, and these things are really baseless. As a matter of fact, there's not one of them that is correct. pollutions of idols is not a Noahide law. The law of Noah is to the prohibition is to serve idols or to serve any kind of physical representation of God, which Christianity, as you know, is in serious violation of. Now, from fornication per se is not even a good description of the laws where you have sexual prohibitions. Of course, the sexual prohibitions are very specific and very clear, and fornication doesn't fit in, just doesn't cover it. Fornication implies if a person lives with someone out of wedlock or whatever, those kind of situations, promiscuous situation. That's not what the laws of the sexual prohibitions are. They're very specific and very detailed, and there are specific prohibitions. And fornication in general is not a prohibition. It's not a prohibition of the seven laws of Noah. Now, of course, I know what's going on in your mind. You're going to say, "Well, is fornication permissible?" And there again, we come to the concept which I've been discussing all along, and that is that the seven basic laws are not laws that are meant to give a person perfection. In order to have perfection, you have to have more than the seven laws. These are seven societal laws. For instance, if a person speaks evil against his neighbor, that is not one of the seven laws. Yet, we know from the Torah and from the scholars and from the Talmud and you understand it yourself, that if a person, the Talmud considers and it's in the Torah also in Leviticus 2, that one is not permitted to engage in speaking against one's neighbor, and if a person does so, according to the oral law, he has no place in the world to come. If that is his primary enjoyment in life, is to speak against others, to be vicious and mean, even though he doesn't kill anybody, and even though he doesn't harm anybody in a physical way, he has no place in the world to come, because this man is a woman is on an extremely low level of life. But would we execute such a person? No, definitely not, because he or she did not violate one of the seven laws. But is this person perfected? Is this person close to God? Absolutely not. So the seven laws are laws which are the minimal requirement for a person's right to exist in a society. They are not, those laws do not themselves give a person perfection. If a person, as a matter of fact, you know very well, and we've quoted it many times, a Talmudic verse, that the Gentile has a place in the world to come, and that he is as high as the, he's considered as high as the high priest, provided he does what? Provided he spends his days in pursuit of Torah knowledge, in the area of the Torah that is applicable to him or her. So that is a level of existence that the Gentile is as close to God as the high priest. There are no limits. It's a, it is a very democratic system. But it has to be understood. One has to understand the system. If a person just refrains from the seven violations, actually there are six violations, this does not make this person close to God. It gives them a right to exist. It's a minimal, it's a societal law. In other words, there are laws of the Torah that deal with the society, and there are laws of the Torah that deal with the individual. The seven laws are laws that deal with the society. For the individual, we need a totally different system in order for him to approach God, and the system is given in the Torah itself. And any person, any human being who studies the Torah will realize quite rapidly that love of God, even though it's not one of the seven, is certainly the highest of all the commandments. And if a Gentile wishes to approach God, he has to fulfill that commandment. Abraham was not a Jew, was before the Torah was given. So Abraham had the status of a Ben Noah. And yet, what was his most distinguishing mark? That he had the greatest love of God. And he taught people about God. And he removed the erroneous ideas in his society. This is a person that loves God. That is a person that is close to God. And if a person just abstains from killing people and from robbery and from from stealing and from blasphemy, this does not make him close to God, unless he has a deep understanding of the commandments and studies them and truly understands them, and then he will naturally partake of other commandments. He will naturally fulfill other commandments, which bring him close to the Creator. But it's important to know that when God gave these seven laws, they are very precise. It's not just fornication. If you're going to, if you're dealing with this on the societal plane, you can't execute someone for fornication. You can do it. The Benoach court can execute someone if an individual lives with another man's wife. Yes, yes, but not just fornication. Okay, we have to be precise, and we have to. Torah is knowledge and understanding. There isn't like it's not a taboo system, which is precisely what this is. Just taboo. And then it says, from things strangled, there is no prohibition anywhere to eat an animal that was strangled. I mean, this is ridiculous. Just comes from nowhere. And from blood, the last thing. That is the only one that is close. Because it just so happens, by coincidence, that they hit upon one of the rabbis of the Talmud, which we've studied, that maintains that it's not just the limb of the animal which is, if it's removed during its lifetime, is prohibited, but if the blood is removed from the animal during its lifetime, it is also prohibited. We do not happen to hold that way. So even insofar as halacha is concerned, it is wrong. But theoretically, it was a theory. But as you remember, we explained the two sides of that theory. It was a question of what the definition is of removing the limb of an animal. This is just a taboo thing, which they happen to, hit upon something by accident, which happens to coincide with one of the theoreticians of the Talmud, which, again, I said we do not follow that opinion, but it is obvious. I think it should be obvious to you by now, after the amount of study that we've done, which I know it's only once a week and it's not really that many hours if you add it up, but I think that many of you will be able to see immediately the difference, that this is not a system where any ideas or any clarity is being expressed. It's just a taboo system. Now, that's what happened with the people in the Andes. The people in the Andes got caught in this taboo system where they felt it's wrong, but then again, they one part of them felt, hey, it's not right to die either. Does God want us to die? These people are dead already. So it doesn't make any sense. So their minds told them they should stay alive, but their emotions told them they're doing something terrible. So as a natural consequence, they felt this horrible guilt for months and years afterwards. I would just like to explain how a true Ben Noach, a true man of God, would have gone about the situation, how he would have analyzed it. The first thing he would do is to consult with the system of the seven laws and see if there is, in the seven laws, any prohibition against eating human flesh. Now, we discussed that when we said that, we mentioned that there is no such prohibition. We did mention, again, it's not a strict prohibition, but we did mention cannibalism is not even, strictly speaking, outlawed in the Torah. And we said the reason is because, not because cannibalism is something the Torah wishes to promote, but the Torah does not give laws to cannibals because the cannibal state is so primitive it's not capable of receiving the law. So it's beyond, in terms of perfection, it's beyond the cannibals are beyond the seven laws. They're just too primitive to even come into the realm of the seven laws. So the Torah never prohibits it because the assumption is that the people that the Torah is addressing who are accepting the laws are not cannibals. Okay. But the case of the Indies is not cannibalism. There it's a case of survival. Now, that's a different story. Now, so the question that Ben Noach would ask is there any prohibition against consuming the body of a deceased? Now, the answer is like this. On an halachic plane, the answer is no. There is no such prohibition on an halachic plane. But now, the Ben Noach has to also look at the philosophy of the Torah. Okay? Philosophically, is there anything wrong with it? For instance, Maimonides points out in his guide that there is no strict prohibition against hunting, but philosophically it's not proper because it is simply you're destroying an animal for no reason at all, unless you're hunting for food. I mean, just for sport, to just destroy animals is something which a person should not do, is prohibited. Now, that's a philosophically certain things are not appropriate. The question over here is it inappropriate philosophically? That's the second question, to consume a cadaver. Now, the answer to that is that if you check in Deuteronomy, you'll see that the Torah states that there are certain cases where a person is executed and they have to be hung. But we don't have hanging as a death penalty. But the Bible does say that you shall hang him momentarily. They just hang him up on a... just to publicly show that this man was an evil man and the court has killed him, has executed him according to the halacha. And they just hang him up. It says, but you're not permitted to allow his body, the Bible says, to remain on the post. Why? Because it says, because this is the curse of God is hanging, which means to say that man has the divine image of God, and this and to allow the divine image of God to be on a post is improper. It's like a form of blasphemy, because man, even though this man was evil, but what we try to do is to demonstrate to others that this man was extremely evil and he did not deserve to continue his existence. God did not wish his existence to continue, but we just do it momentarily, demonstrate that we take it right down, because still it is a human being, and a human being reflects the divine. Through his divine character, he reflects God. So, therefore, from this verse, we deduce that every human being is to be accorded respect, and it's proper to bury them and to treat them respectfully, because a human being is a reflection of the divine image, as it is stated in the beginning of Genesis. So, the way the Ben Noach goes about this is he must consult the other areas of the Torah, which are not part of the seven laws, but where there are laws which convey philosophical ideas. Now, therefore, ben Noach, every human being is supposed to be treated with respect, and you are not permitted to desecrate the body of a human being by consuming him, which would be a form of desecration of the human body. Okay, a human being. Now, if you're in the Andes, okay, and you're starving, so there are two reasons why you should consume the dead person. First of all, the only reason you're not permitted to do it is because of the fact that a human being reflects the image, has a certain divinity to him, and therefore you're not permitted to desecrate his body. But if you will die, if a living person who actively reflects divine image, if he would die, that would be a far worse desecration of man than the dead person, the dead person's body being used. See, again, here we're not dealing with taboo. In the taboo framework, we say, hey, how could you desecrate the dead? The primitive tribes have these things with the dead, these taboos about the dead. And there it would be perfectly logical for them, based on their taboo system, to die rather than to desecrate the dead, like that's the worst thing in the world. But Torah is a rational system. And God gave us a system which makes sense and which is logical. And the logical system is, on the contrary, if a dead person who is not really alive anymore deserves respect, how much more so does a live person deserve respect? Now, if you let a live person die because of a dead person, you're giving respect to a dead person, and you're not giving any respect to the person who's alive. So, on the contrary, you're distorting the whole approach to the problem. You're distorting the problem rather than viewing it intelligently. An intelligent way to look at it would be that a person who is alive is far more a reflection of the Creator than a dead person, because he's alive. This other person is dead; it's just his body remains. His soul is gone. But we respect the body because the body was associated with the soul. So therefore, it's by way of association we respect the dead, but not because we don't say the dead are on a higher level than the living. That's an absurdity. So therefore, to allow a person who is alive to die because of the dead would be a desecration of the concept of respecting man. That would be just the opposite. So based upon the very concept of respect of the dead, it is appropriate for the person who is alive to remain alive and to consume the cadaver if necessary to sustain his life. Again, in the halachic system, I'm sure you're all familiar with the fact that human life takes priority before any of the commandments except three. But for instance, eating pork or even desecration of the Sabbath. You know very well, I'm sure you've heard of people who are Orthodox Jews, and if a woman is pregnant and she's about to deliver, and she has to deliver on the Sabbath, she is permitted to have her husband drive the car to the hospital, which is, of course, on the Sabbath, a major violation. But she's not only permitted, she's obligated to do so. As a matter of fact, it goes so far that if a person has a doctor that they feel is better than another doctor, and both doctors are available to them, the doctor that they feel is better is 100 miles away, and the doctor that is a good doctor but just not as good in the patient's mind is only around the block, you are permitted to drive the 100 miles, even though you're breaking the Sabbath every time you're driving, every time you step on the gas pedal. But life comes before takes priority over the Sabbath. And when we say life takes priority, it means to say even insofar as getting a doctor that you think is the best doctor, that's how far it goes. So if the desecration of the Sabbath, which in the 613 system is the worst thing that a person can do, and that's permissible in order to save your life, certainly to consume a cadaver, which is not a major, is not as major as the Sabbath, is certainly permissible. And if it's permissible, it's not just permissible, it's obligatory, because you have a responsibility maintain your life, the life that God has given you. That's your obligation. You'll notice in Deuteronomy, Moses always, when he warns the people, he says, guard yourself and guard your souls very much. And this means that every person has an obligation to guard his life. God gave man life. That's something divine. You have an obligation to guard it. And therefore, that takes priority over other violations. And therefore, in the case of the Andes, on two counts, you would be obligated to consume the cadaver in order to maintain your life. And if you did so, as horrible as it might seem to you, as disgusting and unappealing as it may be, you are fulfilling God's commandment in a great way. You are doing the right thing. And the person shouldn't have any guilt. The person should feel triumphant and feel that they were able to overcome their emotions and comply with God's will. That's exactly what the Torah is all about, to comply with God's will in the situation where your emotions go against what the Torah tells you for any reason. It may even be a fine reason on your part. I've read one time, I'm a camper, and I one time saw this book. I stayed at my bookstore and I saw this book that says, How to Stay Alive in the Woods. And on the cover, the gentleman who wrote the book promised that he will guarantee that no matter where you are lost in the woods, you can always stay alive. So it caught my attention, and I purchased the book, because I used to do a lot of hiking in the backwoods. And I purchased the book, and I got about 4 or 5 pages into the book, and the man fulfilled his promise. He showed how simply it is to stay alive in the woods. He said, if you eat insects, if you eat grubs, and if you eat anything that, no matter how disgusting, he says, you will stay alive. There's no way that you will die if you can just overcome that disgust that you have for consuming certain objects, certain animals and certain creatures and certain life forms. The man delivered. He was right. He was 100% right. And he stated there that many people have died simply because they were too disgusted and they couldn't overcome that emotion and they lost their lives. Now, this, in the eyes of the Torah, is senseless. A person should not be... That is when a person lives under a taboo kind of system. So then things and the emotions take over. But in the Torah system, God wants knowledge, wisdom, understanding to be in control. And if you have to consume something that's disgusting, no matter how disgusting it might be, if this is for the right purpose, if this is the correct thing in the Torah's eyes, you should be proud of yourself that you overcame your emotion, and you didn't. You shouldn't feel guilty, as the survivors in the Andes did. You should feel, as I said before, triumphant. You should feel great because I was able to do what God wants me to do. And how fortunate I am that I have the Torah as a guide to tell me what to do in every situation, to know precisely what God's will is. And you should feel elated and happy that you have the proper information and that you're able to control your emotions. Your emotions are under the guidance of your mind, your understanding, and your knowledge which God gave you. That is the true attitude of the Ben Noach. So that's why, as I said, from studying when we study these laws about what is prohibited and what is not, we consider ourselves very fortunate that we have a guide that tells us precisely what to do under any circumstance. And it is amazing how the Torah covers every possible circumstance. And in the unusual case that a particular circumstance is not there, we simply go back to the sources, which are enormous, and we draw logical conclusions from those sources as to what one should do in the new case, which the unusual new case, which is not to be found in the in the case laws of the Torah. So we are fortunate that we have such a system. But I wish to emphasize and reemphasize the fact that it is not a taboo system. Other religions have taboos. We don't have taboo. We have Torah. And Torah is based upon knowledge and understanding. Okay, if there's any questions at this point, I'll be glad to take them. I just didn't want to leave that Andes episode, you know, without explaining it more fully, because I think it's an excellent example of how the religious Christian, and these were religious Christians, how the religious Christian would approach the situation and have the Ben Noach, the Torah personality. And when I say Ben Noach, of course, I mean Ben Israel, Ben Noach, because we're all in, under the same system, and it's just a question of what's mandatory, but we all live by the same ideas, principles, and halachic system. So the difference is a dramatic one in this particular incident between the two different approaches, and I think it's excellent for people who have gone
Rabbi,
this far.
Rabbi,
to be able to see. Yes, go ahead.
Charles Gangers, he's got a question.
Okay, sure.
How you doing?
Oh, good. Thank you.
My question is, and I don't really have a specific here, so it may be hard to answer, but where do you start searching for an answer of a question you have? Because what we have to read here is the Torah and the writings. And so let's say you, I guess what I'm looking for is a foundation of looking for any answer. What should be the basis that if you have a question of, say, in today's economy that we're trying to search for, and it doesn't have to be necessarily monetary or anything like that, so I'm not trying to refer just to something to, you know, whether to make money or not. I'm just saying anything that,
right.
Where would you start? Where,
okay.
How do you approach finding an answer to a question?
Okay.
What should be the sources, A, B, C, that you would refer or the guidance to go to that?
Okay. Good question. That's a good question. Your question takes in more, covers more than at first, you know, than it would seem at first sight. So let me just elaborate a little bit. With regard to the monetary areas, the Torah is profound and proficient and broad and expansive insofar as the laws, the monetary laws. They are so specific and detailed. There is an entire gigantic volume which serves as the basis of all questions of monetary law. Okay? The Shulchan Aruch is a compilation. Of course, it's all from the Talmud and from the sources of the oral law. But in order to make it simple, they compiled it into they compiled the Shulchan Aruch into several volumes that deal with different areas. One of the areas is the monetary area. There is not a situation that you cannot find in that source. And again, there may be. And things that are new, you know, I mean, there are mortgages, there's interest. There are some, like, as a matter of fact, my son is now going to Cardozo Law School, and, you know, he's a student of the Talmud for years and years, and he just told me a few weeks ago, he said, I can't believe American law did not take care of this problem until 100 years ago when it arose, because they had a certain situation. He says, it's in the Talmud 2,000 years ago that those cases were already discussed. And I'm sorry, I don't recollect the exact case at this point, but if you're interested, I will ask him, because it was a week or two ago, and I just slipped my mind. But you have no idea how expansive and how much the system covers just about every possible case, loans, mortgages, interest rates, every possibility is covered in detail, and it leans on properties, and you can't imagine how advanced it is. It is far, far superior intellectually than any system that we have in this country, okay, in spite of the greatest minds we have working on the legal system, all right? So there is no such thing as a question that you cannot, that isn't mentioned in the system. There might be, as I said, there might be occasionally a rare case where the specific case is not there. I say it is extremely, extremely rare. Then what you have to do is you have to consult a scholar, because a scholar who understands the theories behind all these laws will immediately be able to show you where that case is going to fall in based upon his theoretical knowledge. All right? He may have to think about it. It may not be immediate. He may have to think about it. And that's exactly what response is, and that's why you have an ongoing process of response. But now let me get to your general question. The general question is also, and a very, very important one, the question is, how do I? When I have a question, what do I do? I mean, who do I consult? Where do I look? Do I take out a Bible? Do I take out a Talmud? What do I do? Okay. Now, the answer again, God gave us a very rational system. And the answers are logical and complete and simple to follow and to understand. All right? The answer is, it depends on your level of knowledge. Okay? Now, to me, it's like this. If you are a Talmudic scholar, okay, and you have a question, then what you do is you consult the works, which are the written law and the oral law, which explains it, and you consult those works, and you find your answer. Okay? Now, if you are not a scholar, what do you do then? You're not familiar with the volumes of works that people spend their lifetimes studying. So what do you do? Or you don't have to be a Ben Elif. You're a Ben Israel. Not every Ben Israel knows the Torah. Okay? They're a plain businessman. He doesn't spend his days and his nights poring over volumes of Talmud. So he's a plain man. You know, he's a fine, upstanding man, but he's not a great scholar. What does he do? The answer is, what you do is, you have the right to choose for yourself any authentic scholar that you feel is qualified to give you the best answer. And you have a right to say, I trust this person. He is a scholar. You have to make sure that he's an authentic scholar. You can't just say, I trust this man because he has a great personality or because he's such a nice man and he calls himself a rabbi. That is not enough. He must be an authentic scholar. Authentic scholar means that he has, in today's world, we don't have any real ordination, but the reason why we give ordination today is as an indication, which would that the person has the knowledge. So he should be an individual that is ordained by one of the yeshivos, the seminaries of Torah study that are recognized among those who keep the 613 mitzvahs, the 613 commandments, the Orthodox Jews. So anyone who has that qualification, you have a right to choose from among any of those and say, I will follow this person. And what I will ask my question to him. I will always, I go by his judgment. You have a right to do that. Now, there is an intermediary case. There is a case where a person may have a level of knowledge, and he may have two scholars that he feels have more knowledge than him, and he might go and raise the question, and he might have a question, and he may find that one scholar says one way, another scholar says another way. Now, what does he do in that situation, where he's confronted with two scholars, both authentic scholars? One says A, one says B. What does the person do? Okay? Now, if the person has no knowledge, has zero knowledge, so then we say that he should go to there are options over here, and I don't want to make it too confusing, because it's not really difficult. It's just there are different cases, and Torah does take some kind of intellectual apprehension. So you have to follow along with me a little bit. But if you listen carefully, I don't think you have any problem understanding it. You have a right either in that case where you have this argument, this debate. One says A, one says B. What do I do? So, again, you have a right, if you wish, to always follow one scholar. Just like a person has a right to say, well, this is my physician, this is my doctor. That's a rational thing to do. That makes sense. A person has a right to this. I rely on what he says. That is a rational thing. Same thing over here. You have a right to say, this is my rabbi, this is my scholar, I follow whatever he says. And in most synagogues, that's exactly what happens. When the synagogue takes a rabbi, the understanding is that they're going to follow his opinion. Now, there may be many arguments, but they are deferring to his opinion. That is one method. There is another method, however, also. You don't have to always say, I trust this person implicitly with everything he says. You have a right to say, I don't know, I trust him, he has knowledge, but over here I'm not sure, because this other guy has knowledge too. Why should I follow this one? So then, you could either, if it's a question of a Torah law, you're supposed to go to the side that is safe. In other words, one says you're not allowed to do it, the other one says you can, so you should play it safe, because you don't know. So just like in medicine, if one doctor said, look, if you do this, you're going to get cancer, the other one says, well, you're not. So you say, well, look, I don't know, I'll play it safe. The same thing is true with regard to the Torah law. Or, now here's another case, if you are a scholar yourself, even though these two people have more knowledge than you, you have a right to say, look, I hear what each one is saying. I'm going to go through the area myself. And if you are on a level of scholarship where you're capable of doing this, you have a right to go through the area. And if you understand it, either in the way of A or in the way of B, you have a right to follow that way. If you're qualified to do so, if you've reached a level of expertise where you're capable of analyzing the Torah and the oral law, if you're capable of doing that, then you have a right, even though these people may be greater than you, you have a right to say, look, I'm going through this area myself. My mind tells me that this guy is right. A is right. I'm going to follow this. So that is another possibility. But every possibility that I've given you is a logical, rational possibility, and it's exactly what a rational person would do in any area of knowledge where it pertained to his life. You would follow one of those options, okay? You have the choice. The choice is yours. Torah, as you know, gives man choice. It wants you to think. It wants you to make a decision. God wants us to make decisions, and he wants us to make logical, clear decisions. That's the important thing. So you have several options. It depends, of course, as I said before, on your own level of knowledge. If a person is a Ben Noach and he feels he doesn't have any knowledge, then he must take an expert. But if a Ben Noach continues to study Torah to the point where he becomes really proficient in his knowledge, then he's in a different situation, and he has a right he finds himself in a situation where he could look up himself the law. He's capable of looking up the law himself, because he knows exactly where to go and how to go about it. Okay? That's a different level. It depends on the person's level. That's the key. But on each level, there is a logical solution for what the way the person should follow. The person has to be consistent, though. That's important. In other words, you can't say, this is my scholar. I always follow what he says. I rely on him. Let him worry about the problems. He'll go through all the opinions. Whatever he says, I rely on him. That is correct. That's authentic. But then if he says something you don't like, you can't say, hey, this time I think I'll follow the other guy because I like what he says. That is inconsistent. That is not rational. Then you're just catering to your emotion because you establish this man as your authority. That's okay. But now you don't like something he says. You say, hey, I'm going to jump over to another authority. That is not consistent. That you cannot do. That's one thing you cannot do. Because you've got to be consistent and logical in your approach. Okay? Did I answer the question? If there are certain loose threads, let me know.
He said you've done a very adequate job on that.
Oh, thank you. Okay, we have, I believe we have like a few minutes left, if my watch is correct.
About four.
Four. Okay, anybody have any other questions?
Anybody?
Don't hesitate to speak up.
We got one coming.
Okay, good.
Rabbi, this is back in the book of Acts, dealing with the thing strangled. Could you elaborate a little more on that?
Okay.
Go from there.
There is no prohibition whatsoever. There's no prohibition whatsoever for a Ben Noah to eat an animal that was strangled. There's just no such thing. For a Ben Israel, yes, because a Ben Israel is obligated to only eat things that were slaughtered according to the prescription of the Torah. But that is only a law for a Ben Israel. A Ben Noah is not under that system. He can eat something which was slaughtered. He can eat kosher food. But as a matter of fact, I gave you a case where he would not be able to eat food that would be kosher for a Ben Israel based upon the two systems, if you remember. I'm not going to go over right now. But I'm just speaking a basic way. He can, but there is no violation for a Ben Noah to eat an animal that was strangled. The violation is to eat a limb of an animal that was removed during its lifetime. That is a prohibition. That is prohibited. And if a limb was removed during the animal's lifetime, it is forever prohibited, even after the animal dies. But if an animal was strangulated, there is just simply no prohibition whatsoever to eat the dead animal. I mean, this is just completely baseless. There's just no source for this. It's something which it was a misunderstanding. If you want to know where it came from, I'll tell you where it came from. Because the people were ignorant, and they knew about ritual slaughter, and therefore they decided that a strangulated animal shouldn't be eaten because you're only allowed to eat things that are slaughtered ritually. But that's only for Ben Israel, not for Ben Noah. Okay? So that's why I say the whole chapter is just filled with complete ignorance of the subject matter, the facts. Just not correct. Okay? Because, as I said many times, the ones who wrote it were not really scholars. They really didn't have any understanding of the law. Okay, did I cover that one?
Charles McKinn coming back with something for next week.
Okay.
I'd like for you to follow up on just kind of what you were talking about here. And that is, you give us reason to know that the... that we were able to eat something strangled, and you, the Ben Israel, cannot.
Right.
Then, at what point do we not carry that all the way through? I mean, if we were not careful, it was like we can do all these things, and
like
it's
what?
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't really have any specifics, but I guess maybe this is just a specific thing of the strangle, non-strangle,
okay.
But. I guess what I'm saying is, if you carry that further,
okay.
The 613 laws and those things surrounding that had to do with don't do, so many of them.
Right.
Does that mean that for the Benoah it would be okay? I realize that's kind of
okay.
An open thing there. But
I know what you're asking me. You're asking a good question. Your question, let me see if I got your question right.
Okay.
I want to elaborate on a little more. Your question is that I just previously stated that the way for the Benoah is to go through the Torah beyond the seven laws and to discover the principles that are in the 613, and you should keep those philosophically, like desecration of the dead, for instance, that I mentioned before. And now your question is a good question. Your question is, well, why doesn't the Ben Noah say, well, if that's the case, then maybe it's wrong to eat an animal that was strangulated, because the Ben Israel can't, because it's one of the 613, right?
Right.
Okay. Where do I differentiate between, where do I, as a Ben Noah, partake of the 613 in order to perfect myself, and where do I not? Okay?
Right.
That I believe, is your question, right?
Right.
Where do I draw the line? Sometimes I'm telling you, hey, look at the Torah. You see that? That desecration of the dead. It means you have to have respect for a human being, even in his death. So I, as a Ben Noah, should keep that. Well, why shouldn't I keep the law about slaughtering also? Right? Have I got your gist?
Yes.
Okay. We will open next week with that question.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure, appreciate it.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you, everyone. Have a good night.
Okay.
Okay.
Hold on a minute.
Okay, sure.
What, hold on.
Yep.